Hey, this is Peter Biello, host of The Bookshelf from NHPR. We're going to get to our conversation in just a moment, but first, a reminder that this kind of podcast happens because of listeners like you, people who value the literary arts and want to hear it on the radio, embedded with all the other news that we broadcast. Of course, political analysis, scientific breakthroughs. Literary arts has a presence here in New Hampshire because of The Bookshelf from NHPR. If you enjoy it and you value it, please support it. Make a gift now, $10, $20 a month. Give now at nhpr.org or just follow the link for the show notes. All right, here's The Bookshelf. This is The Bookshelf from NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. Daily life can be stressful. There's work, family, social obligations. Bills need to be paid, the dog needs to be walked, birthdays need to be remembered, funerals need to be attended. For poet Matt W. Miller, when you add all this up, the word drowning comes to mind. In his new book, The Wounded for the Water, he explores this kind of metaphorical drowning in musical, resonant depictions of little moments we can all relate to. I spoke to Miller about his work in his classroom at Phillips Exeter Academy, where he teaches English. Matt Miller, thank you very much for speaking with me about your book.
Oh, thank you for having me on your show.
I wanted to start by asking you about the overarching theme here, the theme of drowning, both literal visions of drowning in your book and then, metaphorically speaking, drowning in the waters of life, I guess you could say. What made you want to write about this theme?
Yeah, I don't know if it's so much as I wanted to write about it as I was writing about it, and it was sort of coalescing this, it kept coming up as a theme, and maybe just feeling it with young children at the time, with having lost a father, having become a father, and trying to learn what that all means with work, with, you know, that we all go through with the political climate and things going on, things just weighing down on us that make us feel like submerged underwater. And spending a lot of time in the water myself, I was writing from that place, and I just started to see, well, these are all sort of like, there's a sort of connection here. There was things I was writing that didn't have that connection, but then as I was thinking about a book, another book of poetry, I'm like, I think it's going to be something about being underwater and being wounded. And that's how it came together.
And when you say spending a lot of time in the water, you're a surfer, yes?
Yeah, I spent a lot of time surfing, especially out here off the coast of New Hampshire in the winter, through summer, in the waves, and getting pulled under a lot. And it's an odd habit to have in New Hampshire, but there's a lot of us out there, so.
I should say that we're sitting in your classroom at Phillips Exeter Academy, and behind you there is a giant surfboard.
So yeah, that surfboard actually is a board that my brothers and I got when we were little kids. Not little kids, probably just, you know, just past, you know, 12, 13. From the old board shop that used to be on right in Hampton, is now at Pioneers, and it was a board we just messed around with. It's an old 60s pop-out board. I think we got it at the yard sale for like, or the board shop for about $15 at the time. And then
$15 for that giant thing.
Yeah, probably. It was cheap. It's not a board that people really wanted, but it was, so we got it real cheap, or maybe it was a little more than that. But and then, you know, we used it, and then it was sort of sitting around my mom's place for years. I'm like, you know, that'd be a great desk or something at some point, or a coffee table. But finally I just put it in the classroom. I thought, yeah, I'll put it up here, and hopefully it doesn't fall down on a student.
let's hope. So you grew up in Lowell, Massachusetts.
Yeah.
At what age did you know you wanted to be a poet?
I don't know. I still don't know if I want to be a poet. I just sometimes... I've always loved reading and stories and playing with words. And I had a lot of, you know, enough teachers growing up in Lowell, like in fourth grade, Mrs. Peterson would just let me go off and write stories and not necessarily what everyone else is doing or read stories. I just fell in love with words. And getting to high school, I know I was more into like kind of sci-fi fantasy stuff and maybe more, you know, writing novels. But then I read a poem when I heard The Learned Astronomer by Walt Whitman. And I was like, what is this? I didn't like poetry before that. Like, what is this poem that in 8 lines just encapsulated me? And how did you do that in so few words? So I started getting interested in that. And I think as a kid, I was getting into at that time, The Doors, listening to Jim Morrison and thinking that was... you know, great poetry, and I went into the poetry aisle at a bookstore at a mall, probably the Pheasant Lane Mall or something, and I was like, a book of Jim Morrison poetry, and what else could I buy? Oh, who's this person? Sylvia Plath, I've heard of her, and I bought her book, and that book really shifted, you know, the worm turned there when I read Ariel, because there was something going on there that I had no idea what she was doing, but it was so beautiful and so harrowing as well, and all of a sudden poetry started to take its hooks in me. And so I wrote a lot of bad poetry during high school.
All poets do, right?
All poets do, yeah.
Yeah. And in this book, The Wounded for the Water, you have a lot of references to works by Shakespeare and also Moby Dick. Are these influential people and works for you as well?
Well, Moby Dick is just absolutely my favorite book of all time. Probably I teach a Moby Dick elective here at Exeter. Well, it's a Melville Moby's focus on Moby Dick. I mean, in that book, he talks about whenever it's November in my soul, I find I need to get the water as soon as I can. I think a lot of us feel that water and meditation, as he says, are closely connected. But I think at the time I'm writing the book, I was immersed in a lot of this Shakespeare and that shows up in it, Eliot, Milton, Dickinson shows up in it, and Melville, certainly. I was pulling a lot from him and using a lot of those references because there's a lot of drowning and being kind of surviving that drowning in Moby Dick and being lost in the drowning and never surviving it, even if the drowning is drowning in your own ego, your own desires, your own one-sidedness and not being able to see through the void.
Well, what kind of drowning did you think you were experiencing that inspired some of the work here?
Well, a lot of it pulls from the past too. And I think I was probably, when I was younger, especially, I felt a lot of drowning, sadness, maybe I would, you know, depression and that I was looking back at and saying, what was I drowning from? What was pulling me under? And a lot of it was me pulling myself under and letting things pull me under. But then you feel moments of that where like, it's just, I mean, we all feel it every day. We're like, I can't do today. I'm so not gonna do today. There's too much to do, too much work. I gotta pay those bills. I gotta get to this kids here, the kids there. I gotta teach this class, grade these papers. I gotta, or whatever your thing is. I got 1,000 clients to meet or whatever your thing is that day. We just feel like I am buried alive. I am underneath this, you know, slag of waves that won't let go of me. And I thought that was something that everyone can feel in one degree or another. And I think a lot of it came out of that and digging into some of those stories where I'd felt like that or I'd seen other people feeling like that.
Yeah, there's a beautiful scene in the first poem. It's an 8-part poem. And it's a scene where either it's you or a fictional you at a bar and you run into a person you haven't seen in a long time who works at a prison. And this person just describes just the awful thing that he had to do during the course of his day as part of his job, and then just kind of grin and smile anyway and say, yep, things are okay, but things are really not okay.
No. Yeah, and you kind of like, I just, you know, you'll do that. I'm doing good. Let's smile and be all right. And you just feel yourself going under. But, you know, it doesn't, because that's that idea that drowning doesn't look like drowning. Literally, like if you look up drowning, people don't know people are drowning. They'd be right next to you. They don't know they're drowning.
They don't have the air to scream.
Yeah, they don't have the air to scream. They seem to be calmly moving. They're like climbing an invisible ladder. But in that scene, in the Gaelic in Lowell, Mass, was a friend of mine. We played football together, were captains together. And I saw him one night, and he was really one of the smartest kids I'd ever known, but hadn't sort of had the educational like help and to get him into that place where he knew how to use that intelligence enough. And great footnote to that story is that he went out west to Arizona, became an elementary school teacher and a coach, and he changed his life. He just got out of that town and he stopped drowning. He went to the desert in Arizona and literally stopped drowning and figuratively and pulled himself out of that. I have to write that poem too because I don't want to leave that as the last memory they have of him.
Yeah, well, that's the other part of the theme in this book, right? To not only drowning, but learning how to not drown and adjust to your new circumstances. There was a poem here where you were speaking to your girlfriend before she became your wife about how to just adapt. And that's part of the not drowning process, learning to adapt.
Yeah, I think she had this great moment in the poem and in real life where she dreamed of drowning in waves. And I said, well, what did you do? She's like, I learned to breathe underwater. And that was sort of like that click off point where like, that's what you need to, how do you learn to breathe when you're in? How do you learn to breathe when you're drowning? How do you learn to not let water be the thing that suffocates you and let this, you know, this immersion, be accept the immersion and be beautiful and have fine beauty in it. That it's, yeah, you're supposed to drown a little bit. So, and that was probably when she turned me around too, was like, if you want to be with me, this whole like drowning in yourself, sadness thing, you got to figure it out because I'm not gonna let you pull me under. I think that was around my 20s. And so I'm like, yeah, if I want to be with this person, I have to find a way to not drown or find a way to drown better.
Well, how did you do that?
I don't know. It's slow in increments. And I think the writing helped. I mean, I had stopped writing for a while when I was a college guy. I got sucked into the, I was playing football. I got recruited to play football, and it became an easy script to an easy role to play where everyone saw me as that. I'm like, and I didn't, it was harder to get to classes with film, with rehab, because I had a lot of injuries. And I just fell into that. And it's writing, writing stupid. I think anybody who's worked in the arts has that doubt. We're like, oh, I shouldn't do this. There's nothing in it. You start to self-doubt. Like, what could come of it? Nothing. You know, this is silly. Or you've heard you start listening to the voices of people telling you, what are you going to do that for? Like, what are you going to do with that degree? I'm like, oh, geez. All right, I'll do something else. And I think when I got a pretty serious neck injury my senior year of college, and I found myself in the library a lot, and I found myself reading again, writing, enjoying classes, and finishing my homework, which was great. I'm like, this is what I came to college for. I had one semester of that. I'm like, this is what I wanted to do. I didn't quite do it. So I think that's why I ended up going to graduate school a couple years later, just to try to get that back. And it was, diving into the wreck to steal from Adrian Rich of myself and writing and writing these stories and seeing kind of the shared experiences with the world, of beauty, of sadness, and that helped me pull myself out of the water or dive deeper, as it were.
I wanted to ask you about the football part because I don't see too many poems these days that reference Gronk.
No, there's not a lot of Gronk poems out there, I don't think. Not yet. I mean, there's a whole probably anthology coming out one day. The Gronkology. Oh my God, I can't believe I just said that. No, yeah, so that was a great, that poem was supposed to be sort of misdirection where two friends of mine who love going to games and love the NFL, but they're not allowed to be in love because they're two women, and Jill McDonough and Josie Packer. Jill McDonough is a great poet. They kind of have this like moment in the poem where they get to touch hands, and they have to pull away because they don't want to push too much onto this really, strongly heteronormative like kind of environment. But they're willing to go out there, but they're like, you know what, we'll let them have their day because these guys need it because they're little boys just trying to pretend they're boys again. And so they love all the references to the coach, the Gronk, Brady, and stuff like that. And then, this is actually about a love poem. Gronk and a love poem. I think, there's going to be a whole series of them one day. People all around the world write Gronk love poems.
It's a prompt for your students, perhaps.
Yeah, that would be. Write a love poem about Gronkowski. They'd be like, who? Because they're not all from New England. They won't know what I'm talking about.
Yeah. Well, talk a little bit about the intersection of your writing and your teaching. Is there a relationship between the two?
I think so. I think being a writer and knowing what it's like to be inside an assignment, writing is, I'm not just telling them to do something. Like, I know what it's like to, this is the struggle with this, or to see what, I see what you're trying to do. I've been there before. That helps. Or really celebrating their writing, like, hey, look, you got something here. Like, oh, it's not good. No, this is great. And you just have to build on this. It's not nothing. And to tell them, like, nothing comes out right the first time. Very rarely. Writing is rewriting most of the time. I think that from as a teacher's perspective, that helps me give them, like, I'm in this too. I'm trying to do the same thing. I'm just a little bit further down the road. On the other hand, being really creative with them and for them can take a lot of your juice out of you. At the end of the day, you're just not ready to, like, I want to sit down and write, but I got nothing in the tank. And you kind of get fried on that because you're coming up with these ideas, you're workshopping with them and all these kind of creative ways they can take their work. Because we do a lot of creative writing here, but that sometimes it'll take you out. It's an exhausting job. It's very fulfilling. It's that kind of exhaustion you feel at the end of the day when you know you've done something really great, but you just want to hit the sack too. You're like, I feel good. I didn't waste today, but man, I'm tired.
So are you off during the summer? And if so, is this a prime writing time for you?
Yep, off during the summer. Can teach summer school. I don't usually teach summer school, but I usually take the summer. Summer is a big time to write. Get up in the morning, get the kids off to where they got to go to a camp or anything, write for a few hours, pick them up at camp and go be a dad. But you spend at least have a few hours. There's no papers, there's no homework. That psychic energy is not being used. So you can kind of do a lot of reading and writing and rewriting, revising. I might dash off things during a year, but this is a big time, those few months of precious summer months to kind of write and just take a breath and take a break from these brilliant, but these kids are brilliant, but they're teenagers and they got a lot going on in their lives and you live with them. So you give a lot to that. You're the in loco parentes, as they say. And so,
yeah, you literally live with them. Like, you write, even write in this book about having to be overnight with them at wherever they live.
Uh-huh. Living in a dorm, was in a dorm head for 7 years, and they'll knock on your door at 11:30 at night sometimes, like, Mr. Miller, I got a question, or I got a problem, or hey, can we talk about something? Because sometimes they just need to talk to an adult, or they need to talk to, they got something they got to work out. Maybe it's something about academics, but oftentimes it's about personal stuff, which is, you know, can be tough. You got to, all right, it's 11:30. I'm just trying to settle down by my family and stuff. Everyone's in bed, and I get to sit down. Like, nope, I got to do this. And some of those are the best conversations, too. Some really great relationships are made when you're talking about a kid who, you know, he just needs to talk about something. Or a kid's been missing, he's missed a couple of classes for a couple of days, and it's Friday night, you're about to go get some pizza with your family, and I'm going to go check on this kid real quick, and you find out that he's really in a bad place. He's been skipping classes, he's sad, he needs help. So you spend the rest of the night in the healthcare just making sure he gets to talk to somebody. Again, there's some psychic energy that gets drained out of you. It's great. It's good work. You feel good about it, but you're also like, whew, you know, that was a close one. What if somebody didn't check on him? What if I hadn't gotten emails from the dean of health saying, have you seen so-and-so? I'm like, oh, I better go check on him. And then, you know, there's a lot of networks of people trying to take care of the kids, and you hope nobody slips through the cracks.
So what advice do you give the aspiring writers in your classroom?
Stick with it. That it's not a short game. It's a long game. It's actually a friend of mine and a former teacher, Joe Herka. So he said, you can have the most talented people might start off, but they kind of give away. They'll stop writing. It's about staying in the game, and whatever they want to do. I'm telling you, don't have to be a writing or an English major. You can be anthropology. I love physics poets. You know, people who are working in the sciences and bringing that language to their work, to their stories, their narratives, their essays, their poetry. Like, whatever your field you end up in, you're a doctor, you're a lawyer, you're in finance, you know, this can be something that still stays part of your life. Some of them don't want to be part of it, but some of you can tell, like, this is something I want to do. Even if it's not the only thing I do, I'm like, yeah, pursue it, stay with it. It's about staying in the game, you know, if you really love it. And if you need to know, well, there's a great poem by Merwin about his teacher, John Berryman, and he asks at the end of the poem, how will I know that anything I ever wrote was ever any good? And he says, you don't, you die without knowing. If you need to know, don't write. Which I love to show my students some way when they're struggling. Like, I don't know if I'm any good. Like, you'll never know. If you need to know, you can get all the A's you want, or you can get all D's, and it's whatever you need to write it or not. So you'll never know if you're really any good. That's a weird place to be. It's kind of like life, though. You never know if you really did it right. But, you know, you keep doing it.
Well, Matt Miller, thank you very much for speaking with me about your book.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
That's Matt W. Miller. His new book of poetry is The Wounded for the Water. And you can find a list of the top 5 books on Matt's bookshelf at our website, nhpr.org. We are always looking for reading recommendations from listeners like you. Tell us about the book you couldn't put down. Our email address is books@nhpr.org. Tell us the title, the author, and why you like the book so much. Again, the email address is books@nhpr.org. You can also tweet us at @nhprbookshelf. This is The Bookshelf from NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening.